I'm John Fish, and the title of this session is Death and Resurrection in Guatemala. There is death in Central America, we know about it, but there's also resurrection. Henri Nouwen says, I think insightfully, that one of the things that touched him most, or that he became most aware of, that he felt that the Christian communities in Central America were calling North Americans to conversion. And I think there's some of that feeling many of us have when we spend any amount of time in Central America among the Christian communities. I want to start by start with some stories about people. People that I've come to know and love very much, and these are Guatemalan people. And then after these brief stories, then we'll get into some understanding of what the situation is. Elie Wiesel says that to listen to a story is to play a part in it, to take sides, to say yes or no, to move one way or another. And that is how I think most of us are moved, by people's stories, by encounters. And this is certainly how I was moved. 4 years ago in Nicaragua, in encounters with people in Ocotal, 2 weeks after a major counterattack that killed 13 of the people in the village. And the encounter with those people shortly after that attack really had an impact on me. Or an encounter I remember with a soldier in a hospital. Who was wounded by weapons made in the United States, or with a 12-year-old girl who was trying to learn English and wanted to go to the university. This was in a little village just a few miles from the Honduran border. It's these kind of encounters, I think, that move us. And so let me say a few words about some people that I, from Guatemala, that I've come to know. And these are people that have come to the United States and come into the sanctuary movement. Juan Jose Gomez and his wife Maria Teresa came and stayed with us for a number of months. He was a laborer in a hydroelectric plant in the northern part of Guatemala. He had to travel over 100 miles from his home because there was just no work. And so he went up and lived in some barracks of about 2,000 workers working on this hydroelectric plant, part of the development of the northern part of Guatemala, which is heavily rainforest and rich in minerals. So he went up there and worked, and part of his rare time off. He had spent 2 years in seminary, but did not go into the priesthood. But he up there, and part of his time off, he spent working in the village with some base communities, and also organizing with some other workers about some of the atrocious labor conditions in this plant. Well, to make the long story short, 13 of the leaders of that organizing effort were kidnapped, tortured, and killed. Juan Jose himself was captured and put in prison for 3 days and tortured. Then back in, so after he was released from prison, he left the highlands, went down to find Maria Teresa, his wife, who was not there. She, during this long separation, she became involved in a Christian-based community. A Catholic sister helped organize, and they met with some, she said there were about 15 of them that met twice a week for Bible study, and then they began to talk how could they help each other. It was in a very poor part of Guatemala City, and so they developed various kinds of cooperative efforts that they'd never developed before, and they were quite excited about this community. Well, one day the Catholic sister was disappeared, taken away in the middle of the night. They found her body badly mutilated 2 weeks later in the streets of Guatemala City, and clearly the point of the torture is that she would revealed the names of the others in the group. And Maria Teresa's house was then burned down, so that by the time Juan Jose came back, Maria Teresa and the children had left. Fortunately, they were able to link up and make their way to the United States, where they went into sanctuary and are still in the United States. And then there's Anna Maria. She's a teacher from a more of a middle-class Ladino community, means of Spanish heritage, but her father had been in the labor movement, and she went to the university, became a teacher. They sent her up to the Highlands to teach, where Highlands is where the large Indian population was. She became attached to the Indian community, became involved in their lives, and began meeting with some of the parents. And it's precisely because of this activity she was labeled as subversive. Her father's organizing and her organizing put them on an endangered list. One time they were having a family gathering. She was late in coming there, but the security police picked up the entire family, her two daughters, 9 and 11, and her parents and her brothers and sisters were taken away and killed. And then all you assume when they're taken away is that they're disappeared. You aren't sure that they're killed. So she found herself unable to leave the country while her daughters were, she didn't know where. She began to pursue where they were, and if you try too hard to find out where the disappeared are, you yourself become labeled as subversive and placed in danger. So after threats on her life, she left with her other two daughters and came to the United States, and she's in sanctuary in Chicago. And then there's Nicholas, Nicholas and Teresa, and their four children who are in sanctuary at University Church, where I participate. Nicholas is a Mayan Indian. 60-65% of Guatemalans are Indians. This is the center of the Mayan civilization. He's from the province of Quiché. And he was a leader in his community. He spoke Quiché, Kak-Kichel, and Mam, three of the 22 indigenous languages. And even though he never went to school, he was designated fairly early as one of the leaders. Well, when the Catholic Church, after Vatican II, began to really begin to identify with the communities, they identified Nicholas as someone who would be part of them, and he was glad to do it, and he became a catechist. He helped the priest translate the parts of the Bible in the Quiché. Well, Nicholas got involved in this and helping the priest with developing cooperatives. Again, to make the story short, we'll get into this. The priest was killed. Nicholas's two parents were killed by aerial bombing. Guatemala government bombed its own communities. One of Nicholas's sisters was shot by the army, and a brother was kidnapped, and other brothers fled into the mountains when there was massacres in their villages. And Nicholas found it impossible to stay in that country, so he and his wife and children, with the help of the Bishop of Quiché and Catholic sisters in Guatemala City, got him airplane tickets, and he flew to Mexico City and stayed in Mexico for a while, and then made it to the United States and is in sanctuary. Well, I say this to give you a feel for how I got interested, and how because to hear these stories and to know these people is to be part of their story and to take sides. So we can no longer say this is we didn't know now about the massacre of Panzos, or about the massacres in Alta Verapaz or Quiché or Chimaltenango or Santiago Atitlan. 50 here, 200 there, 30 in another place. 440 villages, by the military's own admission, have been destroyed, eliminated. We can no longer say we don't know about the 100,000 people that have been killed and the 38,000 that have been disappeared since 1970. And still, even though supposedly a civilian government, the 40 to 50 extrajudicial killings each month in Guatemala. So in the next few minutes, I want to say a little more about Guatemala because I want to have us understand this situation. And as Jody said in the introduction, I want to focus on Guatemala. We've heard so much about Nicaragua. We do hear about El Salvador. Guatemala is such a beautiful country, and we've contributed so enormously to this genocide and this sadness. And we've also allowed ourselves not to know about it. I just came across today a quote by Noam Chomsky. If we had the moral courage, we would not let a day pass without hearing the cries of the victims. The daily press would carry front page pictures of children dying of malnutrition and disease in the countries where order reigns and crops and beef are exported to the American market, with an explanation of why this is so. And I think the same is true of Namibia. Once you begin to understand a situation, you're appalled that you've allowed yourself, or you're in a country that almost allows you to screen this out. So I want us to focus on Guatemala. It's a major, it's the center of Mayan civilization. People live productively and peacefully for centuries. 1524 was the beginning of a Spanish conquest. And in 1821, there was independence from Spain. But then pretty much the church and the Spanish culture had established a major foothold, declared independence from Spain. In short, what happened relates to three major partners. One major partner are the landowners, primarily Spanish and descent of the Spanish culture, which they call Ladino. They really took the land. They stole the land from those who had it. And of course, those of us in U.S. history know we have a similar pattern. The new landowners developed relationship with U.S. corporations, which still flourish, but of course the famous ones were like United Fruit, but now Monsanto, McDonald's, and on have, so there'd been a linkage, I should say, between the people who are able to control the land and the United States. So the landowners were one part. The military was another major partner. And the military's alliance with the landholders meant that you could use the force of arms to control what you have expropriated. And the third partner was the church that blessed this entire operation. And brought a kind of hierarchical vision that the people that were most oppressed would be rewarded in some other life, and that the way things were now was ordained by God and should never be challenged or resisted. Well, it wasn't until recently that these three enterprises are being challenged. Let me just say a few things about the geography of Guatemala in this very small map, which you can't see. But I'll pretend that you can. Guatemala, for those of us who don't know. And I must say, when I went down, the church sent me down to Nicaragua, I had to get a map out and find out where Nicaragua was. I couldn't have placed the five countries down there in any order. I knew their names, but for those of you who were like I am, and most of us are that way, Guatemala is the one immediately south of Mexico. So you go through Mexico, and then next thing you come to is Guatemala. And it curves around. So the south, Guatemala has a south coast that's on the Pacific. The northern part of Guatemala is jungle in the Petén, or highlands in the mountains. It's almost like this, except not as pointed and not as high. But we're up 8,000 feet in Quetzaltenango, in Chichicastenango, Chimaltenango. You're up in the mountains, in the highlands, and these are very small farms up there. And primarily, it's population is the Indian population are in the highlands. Larger farms on the east coast that border on Honduras, and a more of a middle class population. Then on the south, there is the lowlands, the coastal lands, the large plantations, which they call fincas. A plantation is a finca. These large fincas on the lowlands. That's where United Fruit had all these large banana plantations. Then later, they went into sugar, a lot of sugar plantations, and then cotton. And now the market is such that none of those are, they're using the land for cattle. And that's very low in terms of labor needs, unlike bananas and cotton and that needed labor. The cattle raising doesn't need much labor, so it aggravates a problem I'll mention later, very shortly. That basically, and there's a, we could explore more the geography, but basically that's it. You have the indigenous living primarily in the highlands, a mile high. It's cool. It's like this. When we were down there. In April, it was 45, 50 degrees in the morning. Down on the coast, it's 90, 95 degrees. So there's a... But the indigenous will work, have little plots of land up here, which cannot support them. And they will be put on big vans, packed into them, and driven down and work the plantations for 2 or 3 months. And bring back very little money because they're not paid at all, they're paid at the end, and they take out of their pay everything. If they break a branch of a coffee plant, that's deducted, and everything is deducted. So they really can't make much money, but they barely survive by working on the plantations. Part of the idea Nicholas says about the cooperatives, Nicholas told many stories about this. Was one time, he said he was taken down on the bus, and they didn't like the work he was doing, so they just kicked him off the finca, didn't give him any money, and he had to walk back 4 days, no shoes, back to his family up in the highlands, and they didn't pay him at all. But he said they just couldn't survive up in the highlands because they no longer had the land. It was taken by government and by for plantations up there, so they had to go back down. A few dates in the more recent history, in 1944, a military government was overthrown and you had 10 years of reform in Guatemala. And they always call that the decade of the blossoming, and they were so excited about it. And in that time, Jacobo Arbenz was elected president and they passed the land reform law. They took 400,000 acres of unused United Fruit Company land. They paid the United Fruit Company for it in the amount in which the United Food Company claimed it was worth on the tax rolls. And the United Fruit Company complained bitterly that they were only paid what they claimed it was worth. And they began a distribution plan. That lasted 1 year before our Central Intelligence Agency orchestrated a coup, because that land distribution plan was seen as the first step toward communism. The CIA coup in 1854 established a what is, had been then, after that, 32 years of military dictatorship and increasingly years of oppression, particularly against the indigenous. And the greatest years of what they call la violencia, the violence, was 1978 to 1983. In 78, Lucas Garcia escalated the repression, and this elicited a growing resistance movement among the indigenous. And I'll say just a bit about that. In 1982, General Rios Montt became president because they didn't think Lucas Garcia was doing an effective job, and it was Rios Montt that established sort of the scorched earth policy that really destroyed the villages in the highlands. The idea is to kill the fish who dry up the sea. Basically, it was the notion in Vietnam. In Vietnam, they used Agent Orange. They used pesticides in Guatemala. They used a variety of things, but it was a lot of bombing. The guerrillas in the mountains were supported by these little villages, so they began to destroy the villages and drove the population out of the highlands so that the growing guerrilla force would have no support. And that was the time of growing death squads, increased security force. The student movement began then at San Carlos University. The entire student body, leadership, was disappeared. I was at an asylum hearing in Chicago where one of the student leaders who escaped had a map, a picture, large, of all the student leaders, and there were 27 of them. And they went over where all of those were. And they were either in exile, most of them had been disappeared. So your top student leadership. They had a big union meeting in 1981, top union leadership, and the security forces went to the meeting, round them all at once, round up and disappeared the entire union leadership of the country. From then on, none of the popular movements could meet together because both the church, any organizing was subversive. Church organizing, healthcare organizers were disappeared, labor organizers, farm organizers. A word about the opposition. In 1962, there was a rebellion among some army officers that remembered the time of democracy, and that was the rebel armed forces. They were quickly crushed. Some of them went to Mexico, but it was some of those, they kept the form of the group called the FAR. They came back in the early 70s and helped form the Guerrilla Army of the Poor, the EGP, in 1975. And in 1978, the Organization of People in Arms, ORPA. You need to remember these except to know that there became four major guerrilla organizations. And in 1982, they formed the Guatemalan National Revolutionary Unity, URNG, which is the major Guatemalan resistance organization. And now they came close, because they saw what happened in Nicaragua, and they came close to doing it around 1981. They had taken over much of the highlands. They had developed major spirit. This is when Rios Montt came in and then did a serious job. Got enough U.S. supplies, and when Carter, because of human rights violations in Guatemala, had the worst human rights violations, Carter would no longer trade with them at all. President Reagan reversed that. And also, by then they were getting arms from Israel and other places that became surrogate suppliers for the United States. With that kind of support, Rios Montt had an offensive which eliminated the possibility of having what happened in Nicaragua happen in Guatemala. But there are still 4,000 guerrillas under arms in the highlands. And there's still a major war going on. It's been going on now for 27 years. I'll conclude this part of it by saying in 1983, Mejia Vitoria became president, and he set in place a three-stage plan. The first plan is eliminate popular support for the insurgency. And that was to continue what Rios Montt did. Genocide, scorched earth. The second part was control the population. And he developed what they called model villages, which were sort of basically concentrate the people, much like we did in Vietnam under calling them strategic hamlets. You concentrate the people in certain villages, bring them down from the mountains, and therefore you can control them. And they have passes, and they can go out in the daytime to farm, they have to come in at night. And civilian patrols, civil patrols. So someone said Guatemala is one of the few countries where they've used their own civilians as an occupation army. Through terror and other means, they've used the Indians, the indigenous, to be the civil patrols of the indigenous population, and they have to report, of course, and they are controlled ultimately by the army. But through these mechanisms, they've developed means of controlling the population. And the third part of the step was democratization. That is, elect a civilian president, establish yourself as on the road to democracy, and then you can regain your status in the world community and regain trade with the United States and so forth. And so that's what happened in December of 85. They had election. Venicio Cerezo was the first civilian president in a number of years. There was great excitement among the population. What Cerezo did not do, like happened in Argentina and others, he agreed not to go after and bring to trial any of those who had killed the population in the past. So the army, and this is what I want to talk about, I think next Wednesday, is what's happened in the last year, although we can get some of it in discussion. The army is still in control. There's a civilian president. But part of the idea of democratization was to use the symbols of democracy as part of a weapon. Clausewitz, the military, I said war is the extension of politics by other means. Well, General Gramajo in Guatemala said, and obviously thinking of Clausewitz, he said politics is an extension of war by other means. And basically that's what is happening in Guatemala. The war goes on, but it is under some different guise. Let me just conclude then by saying what's behind this hidden war. You know, government says communist agitators and all that. That's the usual line. Talk to the people. Well, clearly, it's evident. Poverty, inequitable distribution of land, racism. Guatemala is the poorest country in Central America. 50% of the population is unemployed or severely underemployed. That is, they can't make it with what, I mean, they have some work, selling some crafts or picking a few months a year, and I think the minimum wage now is up to $2 a day, but they can't make it on that. Highest mortality rate, Gene Simons in his book said, and it's hard to believe, 40% of those born don't make it to age 5. 160 are dying in infancy. A lot of, and the sad thing is most of this is preventable. It's intestinal stuff, it's diarrhea, it's flu. There are no schools for the indigenous. 78% of the people in Quiché and Alta Verapaz and that, 78% of the people over 17 are illiterate. So you have this population which is 70, similarities to the Southern Africa situation. A large population which is excluded from all the benefits and rights of a nation. And the power is controlled in the hands of people who came to the country, granted a couple of hundred years ago, took the land, and now have a kind of, are trying to destroy the Mayan culture. The land is the key. The land is in the hands of a few. 2% of the population own 70% of the land. The Catholic Church came out in February with a pastoral letter called El Clamor por la Tierra, Clamor for Land, a very powerful letter. I was impressed with it. And we pressed when we met with the leaders of the church, we said, now, are you going to follow up on this? And they said, no. They got such flack in the newspaper from the business community, from the agricultural community, from the military, for this very strong letter, they decided to back off. But it points to the essential problem of unequal distribution. Poverty in Guatemala is not the result of absolute poverty in the country. Guatemala is a rich country. You could feed all of Central America with that soil in Guatemala. It has great resources. The poverty there is the result of a totally unjust distribution. The rich in Guatemala don't pay taxes. There's a tax system, but they just ignore them. And it's amazing, the disparity there. Okay. Another cause of this is that the absolutely low wages and the almost slave labor that the Indians are forced into. The third is that the use of the land for export crops. They grow, consume. It's the cotton, sugar, tobacco, the basic food groups, tobacco, alcohol, sugar, and beef. And they produce it for other things while the fact that there's been no agrarian reform. And now that there is a push for it, becomes a critical situation. Well, I have gone on a little more than half an hour and would be able to pick up some themes of what's happening now. I was there with a national group a month ago, but I wanted to lay out for you the basic situation of this country that is so close to us and so unreported. But I'm sure we will hear about it because there is a clamor for land. Questions?
Can you comment on the risks of the sanctuary movement? We hear about the death squads that have been in Los Angeles, and have they appeared in other cities, and what's the situation like in Chicago?
Yes, and I want to say a lot more about the sanctuary movement, I think, on Friday. But let me just say now that the risks of the sanctuary movement for North Americans are nothing. I mean, basically, still, it's the Central Americans that are facing all the risks. Oh, yes, we could, they could have a trial or something, because it is illegal to aid or abet or transport or feed someone the government calls illegally here. Now the sanctuary movement is urging all people that employ anyone to employ people to employ people regardless of their legal status. If you had someone mow your lawn you would be violating the law if you mowed someone who did not show you either a birth certificate, a passport, or a driver's license indicating that they had legal rights. But I just want to, the death squad activity, we heard about that a year or so ago in Los Angeles. There are some right-wing groups, of course, in the Hispanic community in all our cities, and that's why those sanctuary people often are very wary in any of our cities of other I was surprised how wary the Guatemalans we have were of other Guatemalans in Chicago until they really had checked them out. So that is always a concern. Yeah.
Is that correct then, John, that Guatemalan, there can be no political refugees from Guatemala in the U.S. The U.S. will not recognize them if they ask for asylum?
They recognize about 1%. This man who I said I went to his asylum hearing, Byron Javier, was granted asylum, and a couple of percent. But it's so low that very few of them want to take the risk of applying unless it's the last. Right. And deportation back to Guatemala still is very risky. As we found out when the four famous exiles where we went back a month ago.
What do you make of the recent coup attempt in Guatemala, and do you think Cerezo will finish his term as president?
I imagine Cerezo will finish his term as president. And the recent coup attempt by younger military officers, it's interesting, the younger military officers are the ones that really are the most aggressive and the hardest. The older ones are willing to give this new president a chance, because I think the older ones, even though they still want to feel they feel they can control things in a more softer way, and they feel they need it. They think they're a little wiser. The younger ones just want to go and have it out. Also, the younger officers are up in the highlands being shot at, and the older officers are down in Guatemala City going to parties and all, making decisions. So that's a little difference between who's on the front line and who's not. So the younger officers, we knew in Vietnam, and every war we've been in, it's always younger ones said, give us the tools to finish it off. And Harry Truman had to tell MacArthur and all that, everybody, you have to tell those who are doing the fighting, hey, there's other issues. There was a coup, attempted coup a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And it was mainly the younger officers who felt that Cerezo was moving too far to the middle. He was not. And I think we'll explore a lot more of that in the next session, but I'd be glad to pursue it now. I think he will face a hard time that he has. Even such little efforts toward democracy.
We heard from a person living in Guatemala, a North American, that what could happen is the military will ask him to step down, and he'll step down because he's in with the military, his friends, that he gets along real well with them, and they'll just put somebody else in. And that's a possible scenario, he thinks.
That's what's always happened in the past. Rios Montt got in because the military asked Lucas Garcia to step down. That's always a possibility. There's a saying in Guatemala, nothing is as it seems. It's a very hard country to figure out because and it's a very hard country to visit because no one wants to talk to you. Met with a couple of labor unions. It was interesting. They talked to us for a while, and then finally, after I don't know what the key words were, but there was enough exchange that they began to really get down with us and talk to us. And then they changed the language, but it was very careful for a while. So the casual conversations, no one when you're in a police state. And it's so dangerous to end up on the wrong list. No one does want to talk to you.
I can't even make that. I don't know if you mentioned this, but in general, how do they feel about the Americans?
The ones I've talked to feel that the United States is behind their problems. That we have supported the people that are oppressing them, and that there's a link between the United States and the landed elite and the military, and that it's always been in our interest to have stability, predictability, and the kind of economic times. And I didn't find as much good feeling toward the United States, oddly enough, in Guatemala as I found in Nicaragua. Hey, I don't know why they like America so much in Nicaragua. Yeah.
Is there anything in the Spanish culture that makes democracy so hard to work in, it seems, to all of Central America and South America?
Like what? I'm talking.
It seems like this collusion between the landowners and the military, and they're just. There never seems to be any grassroots movement for democracy.
They would say there's been one. There was democracy before the white man came, and that whenever they tried to democratically settle things, they either got killed, wiped out, their stuff was stolen, and so forth. So the Indians have no problem with democracy. They elect their leaders. They solve their problems. They work out collectively. They develop community. And we could learn an awful lot about the nature of communal decision making from some Central Americans. I think when you have a lot of money in resources and land, that's when democracy is hard, because greed sets in. And when people are trying to protect a lot, they don't want other people getting into it. So all sorts of strange things happen then. And the United States got involved in that, because see, we've always used the word democracy in there. I don't think we've ever been interested in democracy in Central America. We have been the major roadblock to democracy in Central America. And I don't see.
I think our form of democracy that we want to force onto Central America is actually a form of domination. And we cannot give them our form of democracy anyway. They're a different culture. I don't think our democracy would work in Central America. You're dealing with a different culture completely.
I don't see why a pattern wouldn't work where you elect officials and majority rule. You're saying it would be hard to get rid of bribery, which is a way of life in Central America. And I'm not sure.
Well, you know, looking at Nicaragua, the Sandinistas is a truly elected government, and yet we don't want it. I mean, this administration.
I see.
And because they cannot dominate them. I came back and talked about Nicaragua at length at different groups, and the one question I got most frequently was, is Nicaragua a threat? And my answer was yes. If they succeed, the rest of Central America will want to be free from our domination.
Right. I think that is an excellent point. That the United States did not want to allow Nicaragua to exceed in their modest little experiment. The experiment itself was no threat. Militarily, Nicaragua has never been a threat. And there's no way they've been a threat, but if Nicaragua could develop a new form of government, so could Guatemala, Salvador, then we're worried about Mexico.
Well, if they do succeed, it'll eventually spread.
But I don't understand why that's a threat. Even so,
it's
a threat to our domination. But why
domination won't be there?
Why having us not dominate Central America would be a bad thing to anybody?
I see it quite the opposite. If we would open trade with Nicaragua now, boy, that's a great potential for us. Because they need so many things. The only trouble is we would do it just like we did with the rest of Central America. We would give them the money on loan, they would buy from us, and then for the next 150 years they would be paying off the loan, which would never come to an end.
Yeah.
Doesn't the multinational companies, don't they own the land, like in Guatemala?
No. I shouldn't say no so quickly. It's not. Guatemalans are the major landowners of the land in Guatemala. But there's very close relationships. Yeah. So the United Fruit Company is not the factor it was a number of years ago.
I think we do have to remember, though, that dynamic that not only we're not just talking about domination, we are talking about a sort of a more loosely constructed but actual form of colonialization. Mm-hmm. That whole region existed. The reason we dominate there is that it could provide things at a cheaper cost for our economic livelihoods than we could produce at home, than what we needed. So, you know, it's that they're now raising beef in Guatemala that they can sell very cheaply to McDonald's, so McDonald's can still sell us $1.50, 49 burgers, is still a form of colonialization, mm-hmm. or a colonial relationship. And I think we just need to remember that it's not like our national interest is really involved. These are still indirectly our colonies, mm-hmm. and that's just true.
And they didn't start as our colonies, they started as Spain's colonies. So mm-hmm. after the Central American countries won their independence, then the U.S. came in and we became bedfellows with the Central American power structure. I was thinking as well that our founding fathers in the United States always thought that the Central Americans were not capable of forming a quote good government like Western democracy. So we had to spread this manifest destiny, and that's been since the Monroe Doctrine. First, Europe was perceived as a threat, then Great Britain was perceived as a threat, then Mexico, and now communism.
Well, certainly we've known enough about. We discovered a way, and we'll celebrate it tomorrow with Chief Seattle Day, and we've gotten to reappreciate the ways in which the Indian governed themselves, took care of themselves, made decisions, there's a kind of harmonious way. And of course, it was romanticized in the movie The Mission, but there was something very true about that whole scene. So they knew how to govern themselves, the people, and they knew how to get along with themselves and make decisions and do all the things in creative ways. And yet we call that somehow barbaric or savage or somewhere weird things.
What is your feelings about if we would completely pull out of Central America, what would happen down there? Don't you think they would learn to govern themselves without any involvement from us whatsoever?
Yeah, I'm not sure we should completely pull out. I'd like to see us really give aid to, give aid where it is needed. In other words, having messed up Central America, now if we would pull out of Guatemala, the Guatemalan military and other would just continue the way they have. I think we have to begin. Yes, we should pull out in terms of aid to a corrupt government in El Salvador or Guatemala.
We're not doing Guatemala any favors by what
no.
we're doing.
Oh, no. We should pull that out, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Right.
But all we do is reinforce the military down there and make them that much stronger.
That's right. Okay.
I know the young men in Guatemala, the Guatemalans I talked to, they prefer to go into the army because they get new clothes, they get new boots,
sure.
and they get 3 square meals a day. And they say, you cannot survive otherwise, so you join the army as a young man.
No, that's
they
true.
They have one of the biggest armies in Central America.
No, we've militarized Central America, and Jody was good.
John, I wonder whether you could talk a little, you mentioned as one of the major causes of what's going on at the moment, some form of racism. And it seems to me that there are lots of ways in which we're talking about racism this week here in the Namibian setting and in thinking about the relationship of all of us North Americans to Native Americans in Chief Seattle Day tomorrow. Could you say a little bit more about the ways in which the racism dynamics have worked in Guatemala and how you see those in comparison to some of the other scenes we're dealing with this week particularly?
If I was to recommend one book, I didn't put it on the reading list, but because I read it on the plane and bus and boat and car and everything coming out here. It's called I, Rigoberta Menchu, an Indian woman in Guatemala. And it's she tells so much about, one, about the culture that is so different than Ladino or Spanish culture. And about a total life of being an invisible person, being rejected, being put down, and that it was so clearly a racial problem between the Spanish culture and then white culture that came in and the indigenous culture. And it's the destruction of that indigenous culture that is at stake. So she sees it more than I've seen it before as a racial struggle. And I know that Nicholas in the Chicago is an Indian, and he does not like to work with the Ladinos in the Chicago area. He works with the other Indians. In fact, he went up to northern Wisconsin to the Chippewas, and he found immediately identification with the elders in the Chippewa Nation. And he keeps going up twice now. He's gone back up there. So the Ladinos I've talked to said they've had to work very hard to get over the racism they felt in order to work with the indigenous. And I think it's happening much like it happened in the United States during the Civil Rights Movement, the kind of tension between the idealistic whites and the young blacks at the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement in this country. And it still continues in terms of providing leadership for human rights struggles. So I think we just have not thought about the Guatemalan situation as a racial issue as much as it becomes so clearly apparent in Southern Africa or in our own civil rights struggle.
Isn't there also a factor that's in there that during the high point of I don't know if it was Rios Montt or the administration before that just for wearing indigenous costume?
Yeah.
Indigenous costume was banned. These kinds of things were banned. If you were seen wearing those things, you could be killed on sight.
Well,
the beautiful woven fabrics and stuff that were manifestations of the culture.
Certainly you find in Guatemala City where maybe several hundred thousand Indians have come into Guatemala City, they no longer wear their huipils and their cortes and their beautiful costume because it identifies them. And they just don't want to be identified. They still wear that up in the highlands. But you're right, that's part of the struggle.
No, I was just thinking that it occurs to me that there's a real cultural ignorance on our part inherent, and I would even say maybe a subtle form of racism on our part inherent in the lack of identification of the problem as being racial, mm-hmm. racist mm-hmm. In Guatemala, because we tend to sort of see we tend to identify third world people as homogeneous, and we don't know how to make the distinctions ethnically and recognize the racial dynamics within other cultures. And although we tend to think of racism as being making distinctions between races, sometimes racism can be not making and understanding those kinds of distinctions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a couple of hope, and I we'll just spend more time on this next time. There are a number of hopeful signs in Guatemala, and one of the ones I think is interesting is Father Andres Heron, who is leader of a campesino movement, which is largely indigenous, and he is not. He is, was in the United States during the Civil Rights Movement. In fact, he marched with King several times. He talked about marches. He led 16,000 campesinos on a 5-day march from the coast all the way up to Guatemala City. And Cerezo came out to Escuintla and said, tried to talk him out of going all the way into the city. And he said no. And so here were 16,000 of them. This was April 86. And since then, he's led two others of these kind of Gandhi-like mass marches. And so now he has, they say, about 500,000 campesinos who identify with Heron's, it's called a pro-land movement. And so it is a nonviolent, clearly behind a charismatic leader, demanding that something has to happen concerning this distribution of land.
That just reminds me, are you familiar at all with the Church in Exile?
Yes.
Are you going to, you might be planning to talk about that.
No, I just, it's just that there are two journals, are the ones that, they provide, of course, some of the best material. And there's two groups, one in Mexico City and one in Managua. And I think the Church in Exile that's in Managua has some excellent material.
That's where it was in Managua that I first was
So much of the leadership of Guatemalan resistance comes outside the country. Rigoberto Manchu is in Mexico. There are a couple of the leaders in the United States. But much of it is in Mexico or Managua. There's a variety of questions raised. The new peace accords call for the refugees to come home. In El Salvador, there's been a return movement of refugees going back to El Salvador. But it's only been a trickle in Guatemala because of the control. In fact, Cerezo has asked them not to come back. One is when they're in exile, they send so much money back that they support the Guatemalan economy. And if they had them all back in there, they couldn't employ them. In fact, the Guatemalans in the United States send so much money back to Guatemala that they, I think it's the second largest industry